Good morning. Good. We'll be good. Today is College Student Sunday, and part of the reason that I am up here. But also, before we begin, I want to welcome those of you who are in college now that have decided to join us here. And on behalf of everyone around you that is a part of Delrata here, we're so excited that you're here. We're encouraged by your presence and by the joy and the excitement that you bring when you come here. We hope that you hang around, that you come to the fellowship meal afterwards so that some of the people here can get to know you. And not only will they be blessed by it, but you will be blessed by it as well. Oh, that's my background. Give me 1 second. I feel like every time I get up here, there's some sort of technical difficulty, and it's probably my fault. All right. Well, give me 1 second, because I really do need some notes here. I was going to try to just go without notes and be like, well, let's get it. But I feel like I should just stop that now. Get my notes. I almost just tried it. Hey, does anybody know how to get the presenter notes on when you turn the PowerPoint on? Thank you, Mr. Nick. We'll go ahead while Nick goes up here, because I can talk for a little bit. There are house rules. There are games that use house rules. House rules are basically just a change of rules based on preference of the house or the people playing, the family that are involved in the house. They change the rules of the game based on what they prefer, what they think will make gameplay better in some way. Personally, I hate house rules because house rules change the game. I can play a game my entire life, and then I come to your house, and then all of a sudden, it's different. Thank you. Man, that was awesome. Thank you. I'm very technologically challenged, and so I appreciate people like Nick. One of these games is Uno. I think Uno is one of the games that uses the most house rules. I don't exactly know why, but people will do like some draw 2 plus draw 4 and stack them on there, and then all of a sudden the person's drawing 6, and that's not part of the rules. Or they'll stack like multiple different cards of different colors or the same color, and there'll be like 5 of them, and they'll put them on the stack. And I hate that. That's not the rules. That's not how you play. But just because I go into your house, apparently that's the rules. Uno was made in 1971, which is about 51 years ago, quite some time ago, not too long ago. One might actually even say that 51 years ago is like the perfect age for a game, and that 51 years was not that long ago. So one might say that, saved it. But Uno is about 51 years old, which is the youngest of the games that we're going to talk about. Scrabble. It was made in 1938, and people make house rules in Scrabble. They'll trade letters back and forth so that the game goes smoother, or they'll change the worth of different squares, which I don't understand how you can even do that, but apparently that's something that's done. Baseball is even made with house rules. It was originated in England in the 1700s, and the version that we see is more of a New York made in 1830 to 1840, but house rules would be absurd in baseball. Right? Going from stadium to stadium to change the rules, that would be ridiculous. But the league still changes the rules so that they can have more viewership, so that people will tune in more, and so that they can make more money. And so with however the culture is going, however their views go, that is how they change the rules. One game that doesn't change the rules is chess. And I don't know if you've noticed, but chess is a very old game. It's nearly 1,500 years old, a lot of scholars will say. Is when it was created in India. Nobody changes the rules to chess. Like, that would cause absolute chaos in gameplay if you changed the rules to chess. I've been on a chess kick recently. That does not mean that if you're really good at chess, you should constantly be challenging me because you will win. I'm not very good. I have a chessboard in my office if you want to come play me one game, but then don't beat me after that. But why do people not change the rules of chess? Like, why is that a thing? I think it's because chess accepts that either you like the game and you're going to follow the rules, or you just don't. Like, it's so old that, and there's so much respect for the game of chess that you just don't change the rules of chess. They're not going to change based on what they think other people will enjoy or what will sell more chess boards, because it's chess. Like, it will always be the same rules. It will be chess. Oftentimes, we will make house rules for the standard that God has made for us as Christians, when they aren't our rules to adjust or to change in the first place. It's the idea that, I can still follow God, but also I can make some rules with the purpose of maybe it will help me blend in a little bit better with some others, or it will make me happy. And so if I just kind of change these rules here and there, and I change this standard here and there, then I can still be happy, and also I can still serve God. And that's simply not the case. So in a world of faithlessness, you can't change the rules. Now, let me tell the college students and remind you all what it means to be faithless, because some of you remember Mr. Jeremy's lesson from weeks ago when he defined what faithless means, but some of us don't. To be faithless, it is not like a complete absence of faith. It's not someone who has no faith at all. It's not someone who is weak in faith, who is just struggling, but they're constantly trying to get better, and they're just early in their faith. That's not what it means to be faithless. To be faithless is someone who makes a deliberate choice to remain in a condition that is unreliable and uncommitted to God. That's what it means to be faithless. You have faith. However, you are not committed. So we want to answer three questions today. And the first question is, what are the rules? What are the rules that we are supposed to be following? And I feel like a preface to this question, something that we have to address before we can really get into this, is why are there rules in the first place? Well, why are there rules in a game? Because we have to know what we can and can't do, what we should and what we shouldn't do, and so ultimately we can win. Like, how are you going to win a game without rules? That should be the first thing we ask when we learn a new game, right? When I sit down at the table and you teach me a new game, the first thing that I'm going to ask is, how do I win? Because that's all I care about doing. I just want to win. And so I just want to know the rules so that I can win. I can beat you. These rules that we're about to talk about are what God expects of those who are faithful. They're how we play the game so that we can win in the end. And they're not written out of anger or malice or not wanting us to enjoy life, but rather out of love. Because as we talked about on Wednesday in the college class, God is love, and everything that he does is out of love. So rule number one is just simply finish the game. If you look in Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, if you remember right before this, he talks about this list of faithful people in Hebrews chapter 11. And he lists these faithful people and all of the great things that they have done, ways that they have shown faith in God throughout their lives, or maybe just one great act of faith. And then he gets into chapter 12, in verses 1 and 2, he says, "Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." So Paul sets the stage in verse 1. We're in a race, and we're surrounded by all of these people that he's just mentioned in chapter 12, and they're watching us, and they're rooting us on in the stands, all these faithful people from the past. And he tells us, one, let's put aside every encumbrance, every distraction, every sin that could possibly entangle us. Anything that doesn't pertain to the race needs to be put aside. Any distraction that will stop us from running with the race with endurance, it needs to be eliminated. So what do we do instead? Look at the beginning of verse 2. Fixing our eyes upon Jesus. So put aside every encumbrance, get rid of every sin that could possibly entangle you, and fix your eyes upon Jesus. Get rid of the distractions and fix your gaze upon him. Whatever it is that is going to turn your head one way or the other, get rid of it and not allow whatever is going to stop you from focusing on him, get it out of the way. Get rid of it. He calls Jesus the author. He says the author and perfecter of faith. He is the originator of faith. Our faith begins in him and it ends in him. It is completed in Jesus. It's a rule of the game because to win, you have to finish the game. You can't win the game if you quit in the middle of it. Rule number two is follow the rules. It seems a little bit redundant. But if you look in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 16 to 17, Paul writes, "All scripture is inspired by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness, so that the man of God may be adequate, equipped for every good work." Scripture is inspired by God. These rules are not man-made rules, and God expects his people to use his word as a guide and his word alone. And so he goes to list some of the ways that his word will benefit you, that they are profitable for one who is a child of God, and then says, if you are one who studies this word and you live by this word, you will be a man of God who is adequate. And this word adequate, it means complete. It means capable, proficient for the task at hand. But then immediately after it is another word which we use to say equipped. And it's similar to adequate, but it's just a little bit stronger. So he's saying that we are given the word so that we can become people not only capable of doing God's will, but fully and perfectly prepared for the job at hand. So if you want to win the game, you've got to know the rules and follow them. And third, you've got to know your pieces. You've got to know what's in your hands, what you're working with here. And this is the verse that was read for us here in 2 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 5. The Corinthians, in this passage, in this book, the Corinthians are questioning the apostleship of Paul for multiple reasons, but especially because there were false teachers that were coming into Corinth and undermining his authority. And so Paul writes this letter in part to prove his validity as an apostle, and he closes the letter with this passage. And so right before this, two verses before this in verse 3, he says that these people, the Corinthians, are seeking proof of Christ being in Paul and the same being that is mightily in them. So he's saying Jesus is in you, but you're questioning if he's in me, if I am from him. And so in verse 5, he says, "Test yourselves to see if you're in the faith. Examine yourselves. Or do you not recognize this about yourselves, that Jesus Christ is in you, unless indeed you fail the test?" And Paul encourages them in verse 5 to examine themselves, to see if they are actually in the faith and if Jesus is truly in them. And he kind of says this with some irony because it's obvious that Jesus was in them because of the way that he had impacted their lives already. However, Paul still encourages introspection. He still encourages them to examine themselves, and he does this to prove his apostleship. But the idea still stands. Paul is encouraging the Corinthians to examine themselves, to test themselves, to see if they are truly in the faith. But if Jesus is in them, then what Paul is teaching comes from Jesus. If Jesus is in them, then what Paul is saying is true. And Paul's apostleship is proven. But if they say that Paul is not an apostle, then Jesus can't be in them because his teaching would be false. And so they have to say, yes, Jesus is in me. I passed the test, which then proves Paul's apostleship. And that's what Paul is trying to do here in 2 Corinthians chapter 13. But regardless of Paul's reasoning, he still introduces the idea of personal examination. So your eyes are fixed on Jesus and you know his word, but this is the part where you respond to it. How are you responding to his word? How are you using it in your lives? The second question is, how do we change the rules? What do we do to change the standard that God has set before us? What are things that we fall prey to, things that we are tempted by, that ends up changing the game? What house rules are we making for our spiritual lives that are changing what God expects of us? And I think the first house rule is that sometimes we want to please the players. You can't win the game if you're constantly trying to make everybody else happy. You can't win the game if you're helping everybody else win. Look in John chapter 12. Verse 37, it says, "But though he had performed so many signs before them, yet they were not believing in him." These people had seen Jesus act. They had seen him do things that nobody else could do, and yet they still didn't believe in him. And then look in verses 42 and 43. "Nevertheless, many even of the rulers believed in him. But because of the Pharisees, they were not confessing him for fear that they would be put out of the synagogue. For they loved the approval of men rather than the approval of God." These people were believers in God and that Jesus was his son, yet they were so worried about how the Pharisees would respond that they decided it would be better to please the Pharisees and be glorified by men than to be approved by God. How does this change the rule for us? This is people-pleasing. How does people-pleasing change the rules and the standard that God has set before us? Well, let's preface by making people happy is not at all wrong. It only becomes wrong when we allow it to become a priority over pleasing God, changing the standard that God has set for us. Those who are so worried about making others around them happy that they are taking their eyes off of Jesus and those and bringing it to those in the world around them. Look in John chapter 5, verses 41 through 44. In this instance, we see these Jews who were self-seeking people, and they longed for the praise of other humans. And because of this, they refused to fix their eyes on Jesus. They missed the praise of God. They desire to please man more than truly believing. And that's what Jesus tells these Jews in verses 41 through 44 of John chapter 5. People-pleasing in today's world can look like this. It can look like not coming to a time when Christians gather together so that maybe you can please a professor or a teacher or a boss. It could be maybe attending a place of worship where truth is not taught so that others aren't offended, so that you can make them happy. Any situation where truth is compromised for the sake of making someone else happy is people-pleasing. And we can very easily fall prey to that. It's tempting because we want to make people happy, right? But when it comes at the cost of losing the focus that we have on Jesus, when it comes at the cost of truth, then whose approval are we really seeking? Any time that the focus shifts from Jesus to the happiness of people, you have allowed people-pleasing to change the standard. It becomes a house rule to a game that we didn't make and that we can't change. The second house rule is using other rules. You aren't even playing the same game if you use someone else's rules. Look in Mark chapter 2, verses 23 through 28. In this instance, the Pharisees confront Jesus because Jesus and his apostles are walking through this field of grain and they are picking some of this grain on the day, on the Sabbath day. And in verse 27, well, the Pharisees accuse him of this, and Jesus mentions a couple of people who were faithful men who also did things on the Sabbath day, things similar to this. And the Pharisees see these men as great men who could do no wrong. And Jesus says, well, David did this, and Abiathar did this, and this is exactly what I'm doing. I'm just picking grain on the Sabbath. And they're still upset. They're still confronting him about it. And so in verse 27, Jesus says, the Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was so that man could rest. It was a gift from God so that they could rest in every sense of the word. Yet, the Jews had multiplied the requirements of the Sabbath and really made it overbearing, like the exact opposite of what it was supposed to be. It was supposed to be a gift of God, and instead it was a day full of absurd rules, forcing Jews to abide by the rules of the Pharisees and losing the original intention of what the day of the Sabbath day was supposed to be for. So whose rules are you following? It can become very easy for us to begin following rules written by man in the world of faithlessness that we live in, other standards that seem enticing, that seem great to follow, that are man-made and that are not from God. Using man-made guides or standards can look like a huge number of things. It can be maybe a standard of intelligence that you care so much about reaching that you neglect your spiritual life. It could be a standard of athleticism that keeps you so focused on the gym or on the field that you're not focused on Jesus. A cultural standard. This is how you dress. This is what you say. This is how you should act. This is what you think is funny. This is what you should watch. A cultural standard. A standard amongst friends. Like, this is what my friends expect of me. This is how they expect me to talk. These are the jokes that they expect me to make and the things that they expect me to listen to. And so I want to follow that standard so I can keep these friends. It can be a standard made for yourself that isn't from God. Any standard that is not from God is man-made. If you even make a standard for yourself that is not from God, that is does not align with God's word, then it is a man-made standard. any guide or standard that is made that is not of God, derived from God's word, may I remind you, meant for perfectly equipping his people. His word is meant for perfectly equipping his people. 2 Timothy 3 verse 17. Any guide that is not from God or derived from his word is one that is someone else's rules. So are you even playing the same game? Or are you following the rules of someone else? House rule number 3 is comparing players. Why would I allow another player's ability to play the game, to win the game, keep me from trying to win? It's a symptom of evaluating others rather than just examining yourself, as Paul calls for in 2 Corinthians chapter 13. And this is one that really needs no illustration because of how prevalent it is today. Just this morning and in our college class, Mr. Bo talked about comparing others. And he used Luke chapter 18 with the prayer of the Pharisee and how he compared himself to the tax collector. And it was exactly, I leaned over actually because I was like, this is exactly what I'm about to talk about today. It's really not in need of illustration. You could think about Cain and how he compared his sacrifice to Abel. Or Saul comparing his popularity and the approval of God to David, and David's popularity and his approval from God. Comparison is seen multiple times throughout the Bible, and it's seen a huge issue today. The first thing that comes to mind, and it's talked about all of the time in our age group, is social media. And it's really become a world of comparison. Who lives the better life? Who has the most money? Who's the most attractive? Who does the most for other people? Who is the funniest? Is this a world that God has really called his people to be in, to be a part of? And this is obviously not healthy, and it's not what God intends from his people. When we're comparing financial situations and popularity and looks and all these worthless things, this is not what God intends. And let me clarify that it's not the act of comparison that is wrong. It's when someone finds their sense of self-worth in one of those things, and their sense of self-worth is changed because of comparison. Our self-worth is founded in the fact that Christ died on the cross for us. He thought that we were worth enough to die, and that's really all we should know. And it's easier said than done. Like, it's easy for me to say it. It's hard for me to implement that idea. But our self-worth, and the only source of our self-worth, is found in the fact that Christ died for us. Comparison can certainly be something that is healthy when it leads to inspiration. When I look at someone else who's really good at something and I say, you know, I want to be like that. Like, I want to be good at that thing. And then I strive to be good. I strive to do better. That is not a bad comparison to do. However, comparing oneself to another, especially spiritually, it can become harmful. It can become tumultuous to one's spiritual lives. How much someone does in church, how close one seems to God, or how righteous they seem to be, how much Bible one person knows, how much one gives, can all be ways that we compare ourselves to each other. How does this kind of comparison change the rules? Because suddenly, the standard that what God expects of us from his people, it changes from that to what you expect from yourself because of someone else. The standard changes from what we see in God's word to what we see in other humans. And that's not healthy, and it's not intended. If God wanted you to compare yourself to someone else, I'd imagine he'd likely say something along the lines of, compare yourself to those that are found righteous in the church, those who are older and wiser than you. But he doesn't necessarily say, compare yourself to those people. Instead, he sent Jesus to be perfect on this earth and give us the perfect example of what one who follows God should look like. Examine yourselves. With Jesus as the ultimate example to compare yourself to. So finally, the third question is, how does this affect the player? When rules are changed, even if it seems like something slight, like just a little house rule, the game changes, and the player is no longer playing to win. In James chapter 1, verses 22 through 24, James writes, "But prove yourselves doers of the word, and not merely hearers who delude themselves. For anyone who is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man who looks at his natural face in a mirror. For once he has looked at himself and gone away, he has immediately forgotten what kind of person he is." So James is making the case here. This is a very familiar passage. He's making the case that one cannot simply be a hearer of the word, but also a doer. He must be a doer of the word. And he uses a simile here to compare someone who hears the word but doesn't do it to someone who looks in the mirror and sees their image and then immediately walks away and forgets what they look like. It's really something that's pretty much impossible. Like, you are not going to forget what you look like if you just looked in the mirror. Like, this is something that really won't happen. But there's a word here that I recently found this out, and it really changed the way that I looked at the passage. There's a word here that's kind of left untranslated in verse 23, because people, the translators, really don't know exactly what to do with it. It could mean a couple of different things. But the word is like the word Genesis. And it can mean either one's birth, origin, or it can mean one's existence. And so they're not really sure, translators aren't really sure, like, which one to use. Even though they both imply very similar things within this context, it's still different. But I like the idea that it means birth or origin. And here's why. That means that one who is looking in this mirror, they are seeing the image that they were created in. They were seeing themselves in God's image, because that is what we were made in. And so they're seeing themselves in this image, and then they're walking away and forgetting that image entirely. They're walking away from the mirror and forgetting what they're actually supposed to look like. Is that not what happens when we begin following rules that aren't God's? When we try to conform to these other rules or standards, almost like a puzzle piece that wasn't meant to be put in this place, but you're forcing it there anyways, because its creator didn't mean for it to be there. We change the rules of the game so much that eventually we don't know what we're even playing. We use other standards as our guides and try to change ourselves into something that is not what God intended for us to be and what God intended for us to follow. We know the rules. We've heard what God desires from us, but it becomes so easy to just turn away from that mirror, and it doesn't really take long before you forget what game you're playing. It doesn't take long before you forget how you're actually supposed to look. Are you an image bearer of God? And if so, you play by the rules that are set for us. Fix your eyes on Jesus. Use his word as your guide and examine yourself to see how you are aligning with his standard, with his commands. Now, notice, those were kind of the three rules that I gave to the game, right? And notice that none of these rules involve other people, but all of the possible house rules do. All of the rules that we looked at are here's possible ways that we can change the game. Here are some house rules that we can make where we change the standard. All of those involve other people. However, what God commands of us involves you. And it's because your spiritual walk is not defined by others. Your relationship with God should not be affected by pleasing others. It should not be affected by a man-made standard or how someone else is living. Is someone else doing great spiritually? That's awesome. Maybe we should learn from them. Is someone else really struggling and they're at the point of giving up? That's not good. We should do our best to help them and to encourage them and to bring them back. But neither of these things change your own personal relationship with God, because only you can change that. So are you right with him? Have you been changing the rules that God has made for his people and in turn grown apart in him and closer to the world? Then change. Be a doer of what you know to be right. If you need the prayers of this congregation, or if you want to enter Christ's death and baptism and come out of that water a new person, ready to follow the rules that he has set for you, then come now, as together we stand and we sing.
More love to thee, O Christ, more love to thee. Hear thou the prayer I make on bended knee. This is my earnest plea. More love, O Christ, to thee. More love to thee. More love to thee. Then shall my latest breath, whisper thy praise. This be the parting cry, my heart shall raise. This still its prayer shall be, more love, O Christ, to thee, more love to thee, more love to thee.